appointed king? Secondly, why such an extensive record? Would not a few verses suffice? I mean, we just read 57 verses. You follow all the detail?
No.
Exactly. Why all this seemingly needless detail of treachery and confusion and carnage? There must have been a lot of those sort of things that happened in the days of Judges. We don't have records of anything else. Why should Gideon's achievements be marred by this tragic record of bitterness and confusion in Israel? Now, there's got to be answers to those questions. And there are. Yeah, okay. The answer lies in the fact that God wanted to set forth very plainly the development of the Roman Catholic Church and the way it would mar the work of Christ. What we have in Judges chapter 9 is the man of sin. And when we come to the detail, you'll see that that's why it's all there. However, I'm not going to start there. I'm going to go back to chapter 7 because we need to put this study in its context, and I think we need to finish off Gideon as well. So I'd like you to come back, and what's happening here? Skip, we've moved out of kilter a bit. It's a little better. And we'll pick up the story of the life and work of Gideon at the time when he has separated his people under divine guidance, and he has now but 300 men with him. I want you to notice the language of Judges chapter 7. You remember that in chapter 6, towards the end of the chapter, we had the blowing of the resurrectional trumpet, we had resurrection portrayed, the resurrection of Christ first, and then of the saints later on, in the second night of Gentile darkness. We then had the judgment seat, and we saw the issues of the judgment seat. Then we have, in verse 7 of chapter 7, this record, that Yahweh said to Gideon, "By the 300 men that lapped will I save you and deliver the Midianites into thine hand." I want you to notice the language. Into thine hand. He's talking to Gideon. Gideon's got 300 men with him, but as far as God's concerned, they are only one man. Now you recall what we said about chapter 6 and verse 16. Yahweh said to Gideon, "Surely I will be with thee, and thou shalt smite the Midianites as one man." So when he gets his 300 men, God looks upon him and says, "I don't see 301 men, Gideon. I only see one. I will deliver the Midianites into thine hand." Okay? It's very important to notice that. And then you read on in chapter 7. At the end of verse 7, he says, "And let all the other people go, every man unto his place." So the people took victuals in their hand and their trumpets, and he sent all the rest of Israel, every man unto his tent, and retained those 300 men. Then look at the next words. "And the host of Midian was beneath him in the valley." Now, if I was writing it, I would have said, he retained the 300 men, and the host of Midian was beneath them in the valley. Doesn't say that. You see, as far as God was concerned, there was only one man there. That was the Christ man, a multitudinous man. All of those 300 were incorporate in his body. That's exactly what's going to happen at Sinai. And when Christ leaves Sinai to fight the battle of Armageddon, he will leave it as the man of the one. The multitudinous Christ of Revelation chapter 1. The mighty rainbowed angel. Just one angel. Of Revelation chapter 10. And of course we all understand that. This is God manifestation. The 300 are but one. They represent the community of the saints. So you see, the language is specific. It's designed as a vehicle to tell us something. And then we read in verse 9 that Gideon is encouraged by a dream. Not his own dream, but the dream of another. It came to pass in verse 9, the same night, that Yahweh said to him, "Arise, get thee down to the host, for I have delivered it into thine hand. But if thou fear to go down, go with fewer of thy servant down to the host, and thou shalt hear what they say, and afterwards shall thine hands be strengthened to go down to the host." So he did. He came to the outside of the armed men that were in the host. And the Midianites and the Amalekites and all the children of the east lay along in the valley like grasshoppers for multitude, and their camels were without number, as the sand by the seaside for multitude. Now, what sort of language is this? Abrahamic language, isn't it? Without number, as the sand upon the seashore for multitude. Why? Well, the Midianites represent the Gogian host. Now, I think we probably demonstrated that sufficiently from Psalm 83, but I'm going to take you in a little while to Isaiah 9 and 10, and it lays the matter to rest, absolutely. So there's no question that the Gogian host is represented here in the company of the Midianites. When the Gogian host comes into the land, what will be their primary motivation? Will it not be the acquisition of the holy places? As we saw last night, the controversy of Zion. In other words, when the Gogian host comes in company or in league with the papal system, one of their missions will be to acquire the holy places for the papacy. They see their role as being the military arm, or they will see their role as being the military arm of the papal system. There's going to be a religious flavour about the Gogian invasion. That's clear from Scripture. So the Midianites are described in what you might call religious terms. Their host is without number. They're like the sand upon the seashore. And our minds immediately go to Abraham, don't they? So here you've got Gog's masquerading as a religious deliverer. And so Gideon comes down in verse 13, and behold, he overheard this conversation. There was a man that told a dream unto his fellow and said, "Behold, I have dreamed a dream, and lo, a cake of barley bread tumbled down into the host of Midian, came unto the tent." There's a definite article in the Hebrew. Not just any tent, but the tent. "And it smote it that it fell and overturned it, that the tent lay along. And his fellow answered and said, 'This is nothing else save the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, the man of Israel, the word is Ish, the mighty man of Israel, for into his hand hath God delivered Midian and all his host.'" So what's happening here? Well, this is the dream. Dream of the cake of barley bread. Now what you have here is the tent. It just so happens that in Daniel 11, verse 45, it says that when the Gogian host comes into the land, he will set the tent or the tabernacle of his power in my glorious holy mountain. That's what he's going to do. Now, why would he do that? Why would the Gogian host set up his tent in my glorious holy mountain? Well, it's obvious that Gog is going to take possession of the land, and especially of the holy places. That's why he puts it in my holy mountain. Okay? So the tent of the Midianites represents the power of Gog ensconced in the city of Jerusalem at the very crisis that will precipitate Armageddon. Because the very next event is the great earthquake that overthrows the Gogian host, isn't it? Now, we all know that. When Russia is finally, and this is the drama of the situation, when Russia is finally victorious over all comers and is going about the process of suppressing the final resistance of the Jews, it's at that instant that Christ appears and the Mount of Olives splits in two. Now, the drama of this dream was that when the tent is set up, a cake of barley bread rolls down the hill, smashes into it, and bowls it over. In the same way that when Russia takes the city of Jerusalem, the image of Nebuchadnezzar finally stands up, because the image cannot stand up until it's complete. And it will not be complete until Russia has control of the land of Israel. Because Israel was an important element of the four world empires whose territories constitute that image. Without Israel, there is no image. So it has to have the land. And the last place in the land that Russia controls is Jerusalem. And it's not till then that the image actually stands up. It stands up, it just gets to its full height, and the stone power strikes it on the feet and rolls it over, and then grinds it to powder over 40 years. That's the drama of Daniel 2. That drama is there in Judges chapter 7. Here's the Midianites. They've just arrived. They've put their tent up. And there's one principal tent. And the cake of barley bread rolls down like a stone and bowls it over. So who is this cake of barley bread? Well, you can see in the transparency that barley ripened before wheat. So tell me what time of the year it is. It's Passover time. What happens at Passover time in Israel? The harvest. It's also the time when the River Jordan is in flood. That's why at the end of chapter 7 you'll read at verse 24, at the end of the verse, the final sentence, that the men of Ephraim gathered themselves together and took the waters unto Bethbara and Jordan. Why? Normally, you could cross Jordan in many places, but not in flood time. When Israel came to the Jordan, it was flood time. They had to come to the fords of Jordan. And so here we know that we're in the time of harvest, and it's the early harvest, it's the barley harvest, and the only bread available is bread made out of barley. Now, barley was not considered to be a very delectable food. In fact, it was fed to horses, 1 Kings 4:28. It was despised by men. But it was used in the wave loaf at Passover because it was the only thing available. It's the lowest form of human consumption. So when God said to Ezekiel, I want you to now enact the captivity of Israel. And I'm going to feed you with the lowest form of human consumption, barley. And as a favor, you can mingle it with dung that comes from a man. So you see where barley stands in the scheme of things, don't you? Christ was despised and rejected of men. But he was sent by God. See, he is the cake of barley bread. He represents, that barley bread represents the one who would overthrow the power of Gog. And in this story, who is it that overthrew the power of the Midianites? It was Gideon. And he's clearly set forth as a type of Christ. So Gideon would have seen himself in that, wouldn't he? So this cake of barley bread rolls down and bowls over the tent of Midian. Now, what was the answer that was given in verse 14? His fellow answered and said, "This is nothing else save the sword of Gideon, the hewer down, as his name means, and the son of Joash, the mighty man of Israel, for into his hand hath God delivered Midian and all his hosts." There's the interpretation of that dream. And it points forward to the work of our Lord Jesus Christ in the overthrow of the Gogian host. Now, are we all happy about that? If you're not happy, I can take you to Isaiah now, but I'd just rather keep it for a while, if I can. If anybody's got any strong objections that we're actually at Armageddon here, then we need to do that now. No one's got those objections? Good. Well, we'll move on. Because the next thing that we read of in verse 15 is the preparation for the surprise attack upon the Gogian host. "And it was so when Gideon heard the telling of the dream and the interpretation thereof that he worshipped and returned into the host and said to the host, Arise!" What do you understand by the term arise in the context in which we're in? I understand that to mean that there's an ascension of nature. We've been at the judgment seat, haven't we? In chapter 7. What's the thing that happens after the judgment? the saints are immortalized, don't they? And Christ will say to them, come ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. There will be an ascension of nature. They will arise. That's what he does. He goes back to the camp and he calls upon Israel who are with him, the 300 men, to arise and to go forth against the Midianites. And in verse 16, he divided the 300 men into three companies and put a trumpet in every man's hand with empty pitchers and lamps within the pitchers. Now listen to these words. Verse 17. And he said unto them, look on me. This is Gideon talking, and he's a type of Christ. Look on me and do likewise. And behold, when I come to the outside of the camp, it shall be that as I do, so shall ye do. You see, the 300 are only one man. They're all following one man. They're all part of him. As I do, so shall ye do. So the imagery that we've got is this. Now I want you to notice that in this illustration on the screen that I have the pitcher in the left hand. It doesn't say that in verse 16, but it does say it in verse 20. It says, the three companies blew the trumpets and brake the pitchers and hurled the lamps in their left hands and the trumpets in their right hand to blow withal. So you see, there was a precision about this. The pitcher, which is an earthenware jar or a vessel, was in the left hand, and they also held in their left hand a torch. Now, the word lamps in verse 16 is the Hebrew word lapid. It is not a very common word, but it is used in some most interesting places. Like, for instance, Ezekiel chapter 1, of the fire of the cherubim. It is used in Genesis chapter 15, of the burning lamp that passed between the pieces to accept Abraham's sacrifice, that represented Yahweh himself. So here we've got cherubic fire. This is the fire of the divine presence. It's a divine fire. Now, it has to be a divine fire because I suggest to you, and it's been experimented and proven, that if you take a narrow-headed pitcher or jar and place in it some kind of burning instrument, whether that be a rag filled with whatever, and you put it inside a jar, the fire goes out because it consumes the oxygen inside that pitcher, and there's not enough oxygen to sustain the fire. Interesting, isn't it? It's a divine fire. Now, think about this. What does the earthenware jar represent? Yes, it represents our mortal bodies, doesn't it? Proof? Come on, let's have the proof. 2 Corinthians 4, verse 7. Let me read it out to you. I can probably almost remember it. Paul says, 2 Corinthians 4, verse 7, but we have this treasure, and he's talking about the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ, which I suggest to you is cherubic glory, the Shekinah glory that dwelt between the cherubim. We've got that glory in the face of Jesus Christ. He says, we have this treasure, where? In earthen vessels, that the excellency of the power may be of God and not of us. So here was Gideon instructing his 300 men to take a lapid, divine light, in their hand, but to cover it with an earthen vessel. Because you see, that is our present state, isn't it? And he's just called upon them to arise. So this earthenware vessel's got to be broken. And that's exactly what happens in this chapter. To reveal the light, the vessel is broken. Now it's in the left hand. Why the left hand? Remember our first study? No, our exhortation. I'm getting confused here. The left hand has to do with human weakness, mortality, doesn't it? So the pitcher with its lamp is in the left hand. What's in the right hand? A trumpet. But not just any trumpet. It's the shofar trumpet. And if you look up the words, you will find the shofar occurs 8 times in this context. And the shofar is not inside any vessel, is it? And it's in the right hand, which is the symbol of divine power. It's not hidden away from sight. 8, by the way, happens to be the number of immortality. Okay. And 8 times you'll find the word shofar in this context. It's in the right hand, uncovered. But in the left hand of mortal weakness, you've got a lamp, divine fire, covered by an earthenware jar. We got the picture of that? And they all do the same thing. As you see me do, so you do. Every single one of them does exactly the same thing as Gideon. So they're only one man, essentially. The man of the one. Thou shalt save Israel as one man. Does that make sense? Okay. Well, we'll move on. They were instructed in verse 18 that when I blow with the trumpet, I and all that are with me, then blow ye the trumpets also on every side of the camp and say the sword of Yahweh and of Gideon. And so they went up outside the camp in the beginning of the middle watch, and they had but newly set the watch, and they blew the trumpets and brake the pitchers that were in their hands to reveal the light, this divine light. And it says that they cried out at the end of verse 20, the sword of Yahweh and of Gideon, and they stood every man in his place round about the camp of the Midianites, and all the host ran and cried and fled. And the 300 blew the trumpets, and Yahweh set every man's sword against his fellow, even throughout all the host, and they fled to Beth Shittah in Zererath, to the border of Abel Meholah, unto Tabbath. Now, can you see some relationship there to the destruction of the Gogian host? I'll just read out to you Ezekiel 38, verse 21. And I will call for a sword against him throughout all my mountains, saith Adonai Yahweh. Every man's sword shall be against his brother. Yahweh will set the Gogian host against themselves. That's exactly what happened in the overthrow of the Midianites. Gideon and his men just stood there and watched as the Midianites ran around killing each other off. Precisely the same thing. We go back to Judges 7 and we read in verse 23 that the men of Israel gathered themselves together out of Naphtali and out of Asher and out of all Manasseh and pursued after the Midianites. By the way, most of them were Galileans. So there's a call to those Jews that were in the immediate area of the battle, because the battle is being fought in the Valley of Jezreel. So the immediate area, the Jews of that immediate area are involved. And Zechariah 14 says that at Armageddon, Judah shall fight. They're the Jews in the immediate area of the battle. But they're not the only ones who are invited to fight here. Verse 24, and Gideon sent messengers throughout all Mount Ephraim, saying, come down against the Midianites and take before them the waters unto Bethbara and Jordan. Now these are the fords where Israel crossed and was baptized for a second time, a baptism of the Spirit. This is the place where John baptized. This is where Jesus was baptized. So they took the fords of Jordan. Then all the men of Ephraim gathered themselves together and took the waters unto Bethbara and Jordan. And they took two princes of the Midianites, Oreb and Zeb. And they slew Oreb upon the rock Oreb, and Zeb they slew at the winepress of Zeb. And they pursued Midian and brought the heads of Oreb and Zeb to Gideon on the other side of Jordan. What's that all about? Okay. Remember the wine press? You had an upper rock called a Selah and a lower one called a Zer. Where did the process begin of accepting Gideon's sacrifice? Well, it began downstairs, didn't it? In the Zer and moved up to the top one. So there were stages. Here first, second then. That same principle is followed here. What we have in verse 25 is the sweep of the divine judgments from Armageddon to the overthrow of the papal system. And I'll show you what I mean. The Midianites represent the Gogian Confederacy. Now what we need to do is to turn our Bibles to Isaiah 9 and 10. Firstly, Isaiah 9:4. Which says, in the context of verses 5, 6, and 7, which you'll see has reference to Armageddon, verse 5 is Armageddon, verse 6 is about the establishment of the kingdom, verse 7 is about the expansion of the rule of Christ over all nations. That's your context. Verse 4 says, for thou hast broken the yoke of his burden, and the staff of his Shechem, the rod of his oppressor, as in the day of Midian. What was the day of Midian? Judges 7. Okay? As in the day of Midian. Then it talks about Armageddon. For every battle of the warriors with confused noise and garments rolled in blood and so on. Isaiah 10, verse 24. Therefore thus saith Adonai Yahweh of hosts, O my people that dwellest in Zion, be not afraid of the Assyrian. Now the Assyrian is the title for Gog throughout Isaiah, commonly used of Gog. Look at verse 5 of chapter 10. O Assyrian, the rod of mine anger and the staff in their hands is mine indignation. I will send him against a hypocritical nation, and against the people of my wrath will I give him charge. Look at the next words in your Bible. To take a spoil and to take a prey. Where have you read those words before? You're right on. Ezekiel 38. Hast thou come to take a spoil? Hast thou come to take a prey? See? So Isaiah and Ezekiel saying the same thing. And we're being told in Isaiah's prophecy, the Assyrian is the Gogian host. So when you read the Assyrian, you're talking about Russia. So verse 24 says, be not afraid of the Assyrian, Russia. He shall smite thee with a rod, and shall lift up his staff against thee after the manner of Egypt. For yet a little while, and the indignation shall cease, and mine anger in their destruction. And Yahweh of hosts shall stir up a scourge for him according to the slaughter of Midian at the rock of Oreb. And as his rod was upon the sea, so shall he be lifted up, and so on. So Yahweh will stir up a scourge against the Assyrian, just like the slaughter of Midian at the rock of Oreb. But I want you to notice something. It doesn't also then go on to say at the winepress of Zeb. It says the rock of Oreb. Now, Oreb means the raven. And the raven was an unclean bird, a scavenging bird, that could hardly survive itself, leave alone feed its young. It represents Russia. And Isaiah 10, verse 26, is the proof of that. Because the context of Isaiah 10 is the Russian Gogian invasion of the land. And Yahweh says, I'll stir up a scourge against him like the day of Midian, like the destruction of Oreb, at the rock Oreb. He does not put Zeb in there. Why not? Judges 7, Verse 26 says that they took Oreb, the rock Oreb, and the word is Zer. All right. You got this? The word is Zer. And they took Zeb at the wine press of Zeb. The word is not Selah, but the wine press was the upper part, wasn't it? It was the Selah part. Now, how will the Battle of Armageddon go? Well, Armageddon is just the first stage of 40 years of warfare against the nations. Armageddon is to see the overthrow of those who come into the land. Armageddon is spoken of in Revelation 14 as the harvest of the earth. What time of year is it in Judges 7? The beginning of the harvest, isn't it? The Jordan is in flood. That's why they take the fords of Jordan. It's the beginning of the harvest. And so, the overthrow of the Midianites begins with the harvest season. And the first one to be overthrown is Oreb. He represents Russia. We know that from Isaiah chapter 10. Well, what about Zeb? Well, he's taken and killed at the winepress of Zeb. And you know what happens in Revelation 14? That when the harvest has been taken in, the second stage of Christ's battles against the nations is described as the vintage of the earth. And that goes on for 40 years. The vintage of the earth is brought, and the last part of the harvest was the vintage, when you brought in the grapes and you crushed them out in a wine press. So who do you reckon Zeb represents? He's taken at the wine press of Zeb. Yeah, and that's why his name means a wolf. Wolf in sheep's clothing. Okay. It's almost too good to be true, isn't it? Then, of course, follows the destruction of Zeba and Zalmunna. But they come later. They're the gleanings of the harvest. Zeba means to slaughter a sacrifice, and Zalmunna means shade has been denied, and there won't be any place for those who resist Christ's rule to hide. They'll be sought out and destroyed. And you know who's going to destroy them? The Jews outside the land, returning under Elijah. That's why chapter 8 of Judges introduces us to the role of Ephraim. You look at the prophetic scriptures, this is what you'll find. That when God speaks of the Jews in the land at the coming of Christ, he calls them Judah, regardless of origins. When he speaks of the Jews outside the land, he uses three titles. Israel, Ephraim, and the remnant of Jacob. So when you read of Ephraim, in a prophetic context like this, it's talking of the Jews who are outside the land. And that's where Gideon goes, because you see, he crosses over the Jordan and goes outside the land and begins to deal with Jews, or Israelites, who are outside the land. And guess where he finds them? Succoth and Peniel. What do those two names stir up in the memory? Succoth, Jacob. He's dealing with the remnant of Jacob on their way home. Okay. So when you come to Judges chapter 8, you read in verse 1 that the men of Ephraim said to him, "You've left us out. We're indignant. Why didn't you call us? Look at this great victory over the Midianites. We'd love to have had a part in that. It's a bit late to be calling us now, isn't it?" You reckon the Jews outside the land are going to be real happy about the events inside the land in which they've played no part? No. Same kind of reaction will be heard all over again. And there'll have to be a purging process. And when Elijah goes out and he gathers all of those Jews out of the countries where they sojourn today and brings them into the wilderness of the peoples, which is Europe, There's going to be a purging process, and God is going to use them as his instrument of judgment against the nations, against the Catholic nations of Europe in particular. And they will be purged in the process as they return through the wilderness of the peoples, and I'm quoting from Ezekiel chapter 20. Okay. So where does Gideon end up? Well, you'll notice in verse 7, he says at the end of the verse, to the men of Succoth, he says, I will tear your flesh with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars. You notice in verse 16 that's fulfilled. He took the elders of the city and the thorns of the wilderness and briars, and with them he taught the men of Succoth. So he afflicts them to purge them. Now, I'm not going to go into all the details here because we don't have time. But if you read through chapter 8 in the context of the work of Christ in relation to the regathering of the Jews who are outside the land at his return, you will see many indications that this is a prophecy. As the remnant of Jacob are sought, what was it that motivated these men of Succoth and Peniel? Well, let's have a look at it. Verse 4 says that Gideon, having been chided by the Ephraimites, came to Jordan and passed over, he and the 300 men that were with him, faint, yet pursuing. And he said unto the men of Succoth, give, I pray you, loaves of bread unto the people that follow me, for they be faint, and I am pursuing after Zebah and Zalmunna, kings of Midian. And the princes of Succoth said, are the hands of Zebah and Zalmunna now in thine hand, that we should give bread unto thine army? And Gideon said, therefore, when Yahweh delivered Zebah and Zalmunna into mine hand, then will I tear your flesh, etc. What was their motivation? Why did they refuse him bread? I mean, why not give him something? Get rid of him. Think about it for a while. Exactly. Exactly. If they gave Gideon bread and he didn't capture the Midianites and destroy them, then they would come back and say, we've got a bone to pick with you. And you see, they were thinking about the future and self-preservation. No one can tell me that the Jews of this of our world today who live in countries other than Israel have got anything in mind but self-preservation. And that's what will activate them in that day. What about the men of Peniel? What was their problem? Verse 8. And he went up thence to Peniel and spake unto them likewise, and the men of Peniel answered and said, as the men of Succoth had said. So his answer was in verse 9, when I come again in peace, I will break down this tower. So what was their confidence? I will break down this tower. Well, a tower is a place where you went for protection. You built a tower so you could protect yourself. The next chapter, chapter 9, refers to two towers, doesn't it? The tower in which the men of Shechem took refuge and got burnt to a cinder, and the tower in Thebes, which Abimelech would have done the same thing to if he hadn't been killed by a woman with a millstone. So a tower is a place where you went to protect yourself, and you put confidence in it, like Zephaniah. I will destroy all their towers. So there'll be no confidence in the arm of flesh. So this is talking about what the Jews put confidence in. What do they put confidence in? Yeah, it's usually dollars. So you see, this is a prophecy, isn't it? Of the way in which Christ is going to deal with the Jews outside the land. He's going to have to reduce their confidence in the things that they have come to rely upon. And they see their survival as depending on their ability to make money. And why would you want to go back to Israel? You know, you're quite comfortable. Don't bother. So what we have in Judges chapter 8 is actually a reference to the second exodus of Israel. It's just a summary of it. Ephraim's gleanings in war. Zechariah chapter 9, this is the first three verses, talk about Ephraim having a role in the gleanings of the harvest. And it's going to be Israel coming back under Elijah, says Zechariah chapter 9, who will constitute the weapon of Yahweh to overthrow the power of those nations who continue to resist the rule of Christ. Gideon seeks cooperation of the Jews outside the land. The rebels are purged in the wilderness. There's a Jewish confidence in power and wealth, which is broken. And finally, in verse 22, Israel will acknowledge a king, a perpetual dynasty. You have a look at verse 22 of Judges 8. Once he's defeated Zebra and Zalmunna, which represents, verse 21, the overthrow of the nations and the total subjugation of the nations, this is what happens in verse 22. Then the men of Israel said to Gideon, "Rule thou over us, both thou and thy son also, thy son's son also, for thou hast delivered us from the hand of Midian." In other words, Israel wanted to create a perpetual dynasty from the family of Gideon. He refused, of course. But in type, it represents the fact that Israel is going to come to a point where they will acknowledge one king who will have a perpetual dynasty over them. Quite fitting, isn't it? Now, we haven't dealt with all the detail. What we try to do is just to run across the surface and show you some of the things that are types of Christ. I think it's probably time for me to say that when I made the statement earlier in this weekend that Gideon is one of the most comprehensive types of Christ, second only to Joseph, I think that's right, don't you? It is definitely right. It's unquestionable that this man was sent forth to display in a graphic way the whole work of our Lord Jesus Christ's first and second advent. And it doesn't stop there, of course, because it flows on to chapter 9. Now, what I'm going to do is just pause for a second, for those who have to depart the scene if they haven't already gone. What we're going to do is just hand out some notes, because it's impossible for us to deal with this in... In 549 to 554, Justinian gave the Pope political control of Rome's municipal and provincial governments. In other words, the Pope became, at that point of time, a political power. Okay, so he gained what is called temporal or political power over a physical place. In 608, Phocas confirmed the Justinian decrees. The Bishop of Rome became Father and Universal Bishop, or the God of the Earth, as he's described in Revelation. In 700, the beginning of 120 years' dispute with Constantinople over worship of idols began. In 758, Pepin, the King of the Franks, donated the Exarchate of Ravenna, the Kingdom of the Lombards, and the State of Rome to the Pope, and so the Rome put his triple tiara on. He had three states, so he had a triple tiara. He was never...